Thank you. 15 minutes is not long for me either, so I'll be going fast through this talk on re-emergence of vaccine-preventable diseases. I want to start by highlighting the wonderful work you all do on surveillance for vaccine-preventable diseases. We can't detect new emergence or re-emergence without very good surveillance. This is a critical component of vaccine programs, and this data is essential for evaluating the effectiveness and impact of our vaccines, policies, and programs. You're the ones who do most of this work, so thank you. In the time I have, I'm going to be touching briefly on these five emerging or re-emerging VPDs. Pandemic influenza, I'll just give that two slides. I think you're going to see a lot of that over the time that you're here for the National Immunization Conference. I didn't have time after Dr. Schuchat's talk this morning to update the disease burden estimate that was put online this morning. She did update that we now say 50 million cases, 270 hospitalizations, and over 12,000 deaths. So a year ago, this epidemic started and emerged as a new, new virus, and here we are now with these kinds of estimates. As far as surveillance goes, pediatric deaths are reportable, and many of you are sending those reports in to CDC. And certainly, as I think you are well aware, this epidemic disproportionately affected younger children and young adults, and for pediatric deaths, we had a lot more reported over the last 12 months, as you can see here, than in any previous other season. On to mumps. We're in the midst of an outbreak now in the northeast of the United States, although the outbreak's tailing off. We've had two MMWRs published, as shown here. This slide shows mumps notifications in over the four decades that we've had a mumps vaccine, starting in 1967. And as you can see here, we have, this is a log scale. We saw a very nice decline in disease that occurred, through the 1980s. And then we had a bit of resurgence here that was due to both failure to vaccinate and some degree of vaccine failure. Following implementation of a two-dose MMR vaccine policy for measles control, mumps benefited from that policy, and we had a continuous decline in mumps, reaching the lowest point of any in the four decades from 2002 to 2005, when there were 268 cases a year reported. Over the last 4 years, though, we've had more than 2,000 cases of mumps reported a year, and this is likely to increase with the current outbreak that we're having now. This shows mumps reports in more detail over the last decade. You can see how rapid and abrupt the 2006 outbreak was compared to the previous 5 years. And then we had mumps cases reported at a slightly higher rate and then went into this 2009-10 outbreak. The next slide shows the focality of these outbreaks. The peak in 2006 occurred in Iowa and in the surrounding Midwest states, about eight Midwestern states around Iowa, and there were no cases in New York City or New York State. In 2009-10, the outbreak that we're having now, there are no cases in Iowa, but there are a significant number of cases in New York State and New York City. We did learn some lessons in 2006. There were a lot of outbreak investigations that many of you participated in that showed the focal nature of the outbreaks, the peak incidence in young adults, many of whom were college students and most of whom had received two doses of MMR vaccine. Two-dose effectiveness in preventing clinical mumps was 79% to 94% in different studies that we did, or estimates from different studies. So this is pretty good, but it's not sufficient to prevent all outbreaks, especially in high transmission settings. The other side of that, though, is, I think as Larry mentioned, that two doses of MMR vaccine prevent a lot of cases, and in 2006, they prevented tens of thousands of cases. We had 6,584 cases reported that year. We would have had over 100,000 had we not had our high two-dose coverage. There's some evidence of waning immunity and possibly waning vaccine effectiveness from two doses of MMR vaccine. And we had challenges with lab-confirmed cases, as Larry also mentioned, especially with the IgM test. Many of you here this morning saw this slide that Dr. Schuchat used also, showing the outbreak in the Northeast that started in Sullivan County and then spread to New York City, New York, New Jersey, and two counties, Rockland and Orange County in New York State. In Orange County, the outbreak is up to, it's declining, but has affected there's been 781 reported cases through last week. The median age is 14 years, so this is younger, a little younger than what we saw in 2006. Range, 7 months to 52 years. A male predominance, about 75%, or 70 to 75% of the cases are males, and this is quite different also from 2006 and quite unique and unusual. 83% of the cases are occurring in two-dose recipients in this outbreak. The age-specific incidence is shown here on the right, and you can see that the highest age-specific incidence, and this is in percent, so 8% of 10 to 19-year-olds had mumps. In affected middle and high schools, where two-dose MMR coverage was 95%, we actually demonstrated 10 to 12% attack rate. My final slide here gives a side-by-side comparison of the outbreaks in New York City on this side, and New York and Orange County on the right. In Orange County, a third dose intervention with MMR vaccine was performed towards the end of January and the beginning of February, and 83% of 6th to 12th grade students, almost 2,000 students, were vaccinated. These data are preliminary and they will be continuing to analyze them. But my view of this outbreak is that New York has a nice bell-shaped curve of coming up and down, and the sort of rate of decline here does look different. There was a big 50% drop from 1 month to the next right after the intervention, and almost disappearance of the age groups primarily affected, the 10 to 17-year-old students. But stay tuned. This is our one intervention that we have for outbreak control in highly two-dose populations affected by mumps outbreaks. On to pertussis. We see the trends in disease from 1922 to 2009 with all the different vaccines, first wholesale pertussis, then acellular for the fourth and fifth doses, then acellular pertussis DTaP for all doses. And then finally, an adolescent vaccine in 2005, with recommendations published in 2006. The insert here shows this increase in pertussis cases, so emergence or re-emergence of this vaccine-preventable disease. A big peak here in 2004-05, and DTaP was licensed right at the top of that peak. So the decline we'll see in the slide after this one. So pertussis control, there are challenges. Surveillance is difficult. You're all trying to do it, and we appreciate your work. 8,000 to 25,000 cases are reported a year. We have some limitations to the vaccine effectiveness of these vaccines. They're good, but they're not as good as conjugate vaccines or some of the live viral vaccines. Challenges with diagnostic tests, especially widely available at state labs. Some of the priorities for pertussis control are evaluating the adolescent vaccine effectiveness, improving and validating diagnostic tests, including training for state health laboratories that's occurring this year through Recovery Act funding, and optimizing use of current vaccines. I think the 2008 adolescent coverage for adolescent pertussis vaccine was about 40%, so we have a ways to go for improving that. This slide on reported pertussis cases in 2004 and 2008, and you see over here on the right the number of cases that were reported in those 2 years, does show disproportionate decline in disease in adolescents and in adults. And so that's suggestive of impact of the adolescent vaccine, but perhaps it's too early to tell. But stay tuned. I think the fact that there's very little change in the 1 to 10-year-olds is pretty intriguing. Invasive pneumococcal disease, and I think you've seen this slide 3 times today, at least. And so we all know how well PCV7 vaccine has worked in reducing invasive pneumococcal disease in children under 5. Tremendously effective vaccine with a 99% reduction in disease, as you see here with the white line. But the yellow line shows that disease rates have stalled really since 2002, and that's because there's been this increase in serotype 19A. There's still been tremendous overall 79% decline in disease, but this is one of the reasons that we have a new vaccine now. Also, a tremendous impact of this vaccine in adults, in all age groups, really, and over a 90% reduction in all adults over 18. So really tremendous indirect vaccination effects from this vaccine in children. The numbers for this are in the MMWR that was published recently, showing that there's very few serotypes for PCV7 circulating now or causing invasive pneumococcal disease. The PCV13 types account for 64% of isolates, and so those are the potentially preventable types now with this new vaccine. And so in conclusion, there's been tremendous impact of PCV7 in all age groups since it was licensed in 2000. Emergence of serotypes causing invasive disease, especially serotype 19A, use of the PCV13 vaccine is estimated to reduce the current, if it's used as well as PCV7 was, it'll reduce the current disease burden by 50% or more. Finally, for measles, we've had an unusual occurrence this year of a measles death due to subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, so this I consider as an emerging issue. It's unusual, and it's a good reminder that measles vaccine prevents not only acute measles, but also the severe chronic effects of measles virus. This death was reported from Virginia in February 2010 in a 25-year-old male who was born in El Salvador. He was healthy, had no history of serious childhood illnesses or immunosuppression. He had onset of seizures about 2 years before hospital admission that had worsened in the several months prior to admission. He was admitted to a hospital with altered mental status and confusion. He had progressive deterioration of function. Brain biopsy and autopsy confirmed measles subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. The CDC lab, both our pathology lab and our virology lab, both confirm measles virus by PCR, and then genotyped it as D3. This is the genotype that was circulating during the resurgence, 1989 to 91 in the US, and it hasn't been seen globally since 2002-03. It was likely also circulating in El Salvador at that time, although we don't have genotype data from there, but it was circulating throughout the Americas. So very tragic death, no documentation of vaccination. Larry showed this slide already, but just to highlight again that we remain at risk of measles importations, and so at any time we can have clusters of cases and spread from these importations. We had a number of outbreaks in 2008. Linked to importations, with these importations landing in little populations where there were high rates of personal belief exemptus. And so there has to be, we have to maintain our effort to maintain high coverage and to respond very aggressively to measles outbreaks. Currently, there's a large outbreak. It's going up in size. It's up to 44 cases as of Friday in British Columbia. started in Vancouver after the Winter Olympics. They documented at least two different importations, one of H1 virus that circulates in Japan and China, and the other was a virus from India, B3. This outbreak has caused two importations into the U.S., one in a U.S. resident who returned to California, and a visitor from Vancouver who visited Washington just last week. The bottom little King County notice here is a press release from King County. They have every reason to be concerned about measles, as other states do too, but this is a figure published in an article in New England Journal last year, showing rates of reported non-medical exemptions in Washington counties. And this is why we're concerned about measles outbreaks and have to maintain our alertness. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody who provided slides, and I can probably take a few questions. Thank you.